In actual fact, the title originally, I don't know what happened to it, but it was called The Fetishism of Commodities, or Is Adidas Cooler Than Nike? When Ron Cook and I first discussed this a couple of years ago about having a series of classes on Marxism, a rather smart ass said, oh, here's an easy one, I've thought a great title for it. And then as things happen, as the months roll on, you say, well, I know all about this. I read this 40 years ago. And unfortunately, when I had a look at it, I must have been using the wrong glasses or something, because I'd forgotten most of it. And that, I think, is one of the important things for the Socialist Party, that well-known socialist classics are so accepted. And sometimes people who haven't read it claim to have read it because they know the argumentation behind it. But even those who have read it many times think they've got it, and that's the end of it. But many years later, a piece of argumentation comes up, and they find that they're struggling a little. Well, I can tell you, I'm struggling a little this afternoon. But what I hope to do here is that, unlike the newspapers who love the anniversaries and have nonsense like this, you know, the 150th anniversary, the Communist Manifesto, produces things like this, he says, holding up a newspaper, or the Observer, which says, amongst other nonsense, Marx Manifesto is bankrupt. Now that's 150 years. I'll not be around, I'm quite sure of this, for the 150th anniversary of Das Kapital, which was written in 1867. And in it, in the first part of it, dealing with commodities, there is a mere 12 pages, which deals with a really grandiose title, which I thoroughly adore. You know, it's marvellous, you know, the fetishisms of a commodity, of commodities, and the secret thereof. People, Chris, this is like something out of Peg's paper, this one. I've got to read this. And of course, the fact that it was only 12 pages, I thought, well, even a fool like me can muddle through for half an hour and 12 pages that Karl Marx has written. But the difficulty here is that Marx has written, I think, one of the greatest insights into how capitalist society actually operates. And lots of what are contained in that 12 pages lead to a lot of other thoughts about the whole Marxist approach to politics. So whether this was the 150th or the 1st or the 200th anniversary, I think it's essential inside the Socialist Party that we keep reappraising and re-examining what we would call, perhaps wrongly, socialist classics, for its strengths and its weaknesses. So what I intend to do this afternoon, bombastic that I am, is deal it in three parts. That is, to look upon the fetishism of a commodity as dealt by Marx in Das Kapital in 1867 as a major insight to how society operates. And secondly, and I don't know if this has been done before, and perhaps this is bombastic, how this fetishism explains many of the modern social developments that we see today in 1998. And lastly, and very briefly, because I know most of you are either socialist or are acquainted with socialist ideas, but very briefly, how it is that the Socialist Party seek a new society where we will only produce use values instead of commodities. Now, to the first part, the most important thing, and the one that I first came across 40 years ago when in a Glasgow pub members were talking about the fetishism of a commodity, and somebody said, I'll have half a crown each way in that, is what does the word fetishism mean? I didn't know at the time, but then I'm not a Londoner that knows all about the funny goings on in Soho. The fetishism. So I had to look at the dictionary, naive child that I was, and saw from the pure dictionary I've got, the Oxford one, that apparently it's a fetish is a word first used from a French word, in 1613, and this is a description in the Oxford Dictionary. It's any object used by the negroes of the Guinea coast and neighbourhood as an amulet or means of enchantment, or regarded by them with dread. And further later on, an inanimate object worshipped by savages. And a fetishism is the worship of fetishes or a superstition of which this is the form. Now, why would Marx use this concept of apparently what they describe as an inanimate object worshipped by savages to deal here in the 19th century, in 1860s, with the concept of commodities? Well, the best guy to explain it is Marx himself. Now, somebody once told me when I started speaking, said, don't use too many quotes, use your own words. Don't use a lot of quotes. So the first time I spoke, after he heard me, he says, use a lot of quotes. So I'm going to do that. Now, Marx, in explaining this analogy, talks about value in a commodity society. He says, value in a commodity society, there it is a definite social relation between men that assumes in their eyes the fantastic form of a relation between things. In order, therefore, to find an analogy, we must have recourse to the mist-enveloped regions of the religious world. In that world, the production of the human brain appears as independent beings endowed with life and entering into relations both with one another and the human race. So it is in the world of commodities. With the product of men's hands, this I call the fetishism, which attaches itself to the products of labour, so soon as they are produced as commodities, and which is therefore inseparable from the production of commodities. In other words, what Marx is saying here is that just as in a primitive society men would produce, or men and women would produce, amulets, statues, objects that they themselves carved, they would, and then would worship these things, they then saw these things that were a human product as being superior and above them, having communication with other inanimate objects and lording over all of humanity. And of course, in a sense, that's what commodities are today. Now, it seems strange to say this, but when the so-called classical economists were viewing the world that they lived in and the new relationships that were coming about and the end of the old handicraft peasant type communities, they were struck with certain puzzles about the market, and they had to examine why objects, why products were exchanging in certain ratios. They then, looking at these things, thought that there was something about nature or something about the object itself. This is especially true when it comes to dealing with gold and silver and various forms of money. They thought there was something above humanity here, some truth that lasted before, during, and after mankind would be on the earth, some basic truth here. Marx, however, being a historian, and all his philosophy and all his economics, what you could say about Marx, he was first and last a historian, and all his concepts of philosophy and economics and so on are taken from a unique Marxian historical viewpoint. But rather than me waffle about it, I'll again deal with what he says about how commodities appear to be something different than human products. As a general rule, articles of utility become commodities only because they are products of the labour of private individuals or groups of individuals who carry on their work independently of each other. The sum total of the labour of all these private individuals forms the aggregate labour of society. And later, it is only by being exchanged that the products of labour acquire as values one uniform social status, distinct from their varied forms of existence as objects of utility. In other words, what Marx would do, based on the classical economists, would look at a commodity and say, what is it about this thing that is so unique? What is it that seems to baffle humanity, that makes them in awe of the market, of awe of these new productive processes? Let's look at it historically. And of course, what he did is he looked at previous societies, pre-commodity producing societies, and saw the secret thereof. What he saw was that all these articles, all these commodities have one thing in common, and only one thing in common, basically, that is that they're a product of human labour, and that the way or the manner in which they stand in relationship to each other is in fact the manner and the way in which the producers stand in relation to each other. Now, it's very difficult to see it inside capitalism. So what he had to do, and he says it in the thing, he says, let's look at a previous non-commodity society, patriarchal society. Now, quotes may be boring, so we'll leave Karl Marx and we'll go to his pal, Frederick Engels. Here's what he says, and I think this is the best way to put it, to understand basically what this relationship that appears to be between things is actually a relationship between human beings, between producers. Here is Engels in a book called On Capital, and I think he explains it very well, better than I could. The peasant of the Middle Ages, therefore, knew fairly accurately the labour time requisite for producing the things he obtained by exchange. The blacksmith and the wagoner worked in his sight, as did the tailor and the shoemaker, who in my own youth went from hut to hut amongst the Rhenish peasants, making clothes and shoes from homemade cloth and leather. Both the peasant and also those he purchased from were themselves labourers. The articles exchanged were the product of their own labour. What did they expend to produce these objects? Labour, and only labour, for the replacement of working tools, for the production of raw materials, and for its working up, they expended nothing but their own labour power. How could they then exchange these products of theirs for those of other workers, otherwise than in proportion to the labour expended them? Not only was the labour time expended on these products the sole appropriate measure of the quantitative determination of the magnitude involved in exchange, but any other measure was altogether unthinkable. Or does anyone believe that the peasant and the artisan were so foolish as to exchange a thing that took 10 hours labour for something that took only one labour hour? In other words, here in a society that did produce commodities, of course, but that wasn't the prevailing mode of production. Here in a pre-commodity-based, commodity-producing society is the simple proposition that all the values that appear mystically in a commodity are the product of what Marx calls abstract human labour time. And behind all the amazing changes in it, the multiplicity of ups and downs of markets and prices, slumps and booms, this truth holds true, that the value of all those commodities that are in circulation, basically, in the main, is depending on a certain historical period, is based upon the amount of socially necessary labour time put into their production and reproduction. That's the mystery of it all. And if you get a hold of the Sunday Times or the Observer city page, you'll see all sorts of magic being weaved about the word value. What they're really engaged in is prices and how to get bigger return than you put in. But here Marx, in very short 12 pages, deals with the basis of capitalist society. Now, why then did it take so long to come about to this viewpoint? Because these people who were pre-Marx and were no fools, some of them actually engaged in exchange of commodities, some of them were what we call today businessmen, many of them were academics. And he says the reason for this is that men don't think about this proposition until it reaches a certain stage of development. And I quote Marx, for the last time. Man's reflection on the forms of social life, and consequently also his scientific analysis of those forms, takes a course directly opposite to that of their actual historical development. He begins post festum, Latin for after the feast, with the results of the process of development ready to hand before him. The characters that stamp products as commodities and whose establishment is a necessary preliminary to the circulation of commodities have already acquired the stability of natural, self-understood forms of social life. Before man seeks to decipher, not their historical character, for in his eyes they are immutable, but their meaning. In other words, the only time that society would have to ponder the mysteries of a commodity is when we reach a stage of commodity production, when it seems mysterious. And you see, what's happening here? Why do so many ounces of gold exchange for so many tons of iron? What lies behind us? Why do markets boom and slump? Why do cottagers find themselves no longer cottagers? Why do blacksmiths no longer pursue their trade? What's happening here? What mystery is occurring here in this changing society, in this commodity-producing society? You would only consider that proposition when it became a problem. In a pre-commodity producing society, articles were produced for use, mainly in a peasant patriarchal society, for their own consumption, and there was no mystery whatsoever about it. So Marx takes the viewpoint, a historical viewpoint, that capitalism has its own laws, different from other social systems. That what we've got to consider here is that capitalism, although it's absolutely based in commodity production, has been preceded by societies that produce commodities. We certainly did produce commodities inside what's called classical antiquity or slavery, and inside feudalism. But only inside capitalism do we reach the point where commodity production is the prevailing mode of production. And it's only then that human beings start to wonder about it and its mysteries. Now, previous societies took capitalism basically produced useful articles to be consumed. There's no mystery about that. Only inside capitalism does this fetish arise. Now, it affects us all in many ways. It affects us in the sense, not only are we frightened of markets, and even the journalists and the press barons talk about the market dictates, and statesmen talk about the market dictates. Markets are made by human beings. They're a social product of what human beings do in order to live. And yet, having created this, they imagine this market somehow or other has a life of its own. In fact, they even use terms like the hand of the market decides what happens. Now, it goes worse than this, of course, that as modern day savages, because that's what we are, we quake before the great god commodity, but also were victims of the advertising hucksters with their design labels, where a human being is not sort of because he's a beautiful singer or dancer or just a very nice man or woman. He's not looked upon, or she's not looked upon, because of their human attributes. They're looked upon by what type of commodities they are consuming. Hence the boom of the designer label. Hence the advertising huckster, who doesn't sell you a can of beans or a motor car. What he sells you is a lifestyle. He sells you a randy wife, intelligent children, if only you have the right motor car. He sells you all these wonderful things. He's selling you a lie. And of course, workers think that somehow or other, if they consume the right commodities, they will be happy. They will satisfy their humanity. This, of course, does not occur. But not only does this happen in advertising, it happens in every aspect of social being. For instance, there's a festival on now called the World Cup. I came across this thing in a magazine here, and it's saying about, it's going to be really exciting, this. Will Brazil do this and will this? This magazine says, after seeing all this, but the fiercest battle of all will be the one waged off the pitch between Stripes and Swoosh, the boot wars between the sportswear manufacturers, between Nike and Adidas. Now this is a gigantic market, something like 4.5 billion a year, and that recent hero turned villain, what do you call it? Beckham, that's it. I knew some English person would be here. By the way, he's quite a hero in Scotland at the moment. because he is wearing or pretends to wear Adidas Equipment Predator Accelerator. That's a football boot, by the way. Costs £100. What happens is he's got a 7-year deal worth £4 million. With £2 million loyalty bonus at the back end. Get sent off again, of course, that loyalty bonus is in a bit of danger. But what's happened is billions of pounds are spent in these so-called sporting events. For instance, one of the favourites for it, Brazil, have got a deal with Nike in this case, where they get $400 million over a 10-year deal. Part of that is that Nike tell them what games they'll play and in what countries they'll play, and they also get the TV thing. So in other words, although Brazil may or may not win the World Cup and may be a good or bad football club, is rather unimportant. What happens is Nike, who own and control most of their basketball wear produced in the United States, a gigantic market, are concerned about this fact that football is a more worldwide sport. So what they want is South America, Australia, so on. In fact, if you watch the television, you'd see those teams with a wee tick on them. I think there's about half a dozen of them that paid millions pound and dollars and Australian dollars and so on. Although it seems that money's thrown away, they're thinking of a future market here. And that, of course, is another reason why the Pacific Rim places like Japan and North Korea are going to figure in the next one. But of course, tragedy for them, as capitalism is so unpredictable, it looks as if that market may have collapsed a little. But who knows in 4 years' time. So here's sport, which I suppose should be a healthy, enjoyable exercise, where football players, even the best football players in the world, are dictated to by the manufacturers of a particular boot to satisfy markets, who run Orte sports events. For instance, Adidas ran an event called the 2 mile million dollar race. Now, 2 miles is not even used in any sporting event, but they just made this one up between two athletes. I'll not say their name because I'll just make a mess of it. One from Algeria and one from Ethiopia. The prize for a 2 mile world record was $1 million. They sponsored it, they ran it. They didn't, of course, have one of the top Kenyan runners, Daniel Coleman, who would have probably won it, because he sponsored by Nike. I mean, this is so-called sport and competition and that. It's just a con, of course. It's in order to sell, to move products. Now, if it's bad in that respect, in the National Football League in America last January, when I was over there, and San Francisco Examiner informs us that over 8 years of television contract to 30 clubs there will amount to at least $17.6 billion. This is the sort of money, because this is the sort of market that they're after, and where people are viewed here what kind of sports gear they wear. Although, again, I could quote here that most of the sports gear is produced for guys with big fat beer barrels who never run anywhere, and all the trainers and that. And only about 20% of the gear that they sell is actually used for sporting activity. The rest is to wear a label and say, look at me, I am the sum total of the commodities I consume. That's bad enough, but here again in the same paper, the San Francisco Examiner, we read about how the school is seen as a marvellous target for commodity sellers in the United States of America. Some people are getting a bit concerned about it. The buses, they're given buses which advertise the product. They're also beaming news and commercial televisions into 12,000 of the national schools in the United States of America, reaching, they reckon, something like 8 million teenagers. And what they do here, because they put a little bit of information and education that the teacher can use on it, and every 10 minutes they'll have a 2-minute flashes of adverts for Pepsi, Reebok and all the rest of it. And they bribe the schools concerned with TV monitors, VCRs, satellite dishes and so on. In fact, what happens here is that they reckon that the teenage market, the school market there, is something like $109 billion. So rather than educate them, what they're doing is they're seeing them as potential customers. Now, so a typical American, but here in sensible old Britain, we know what education is. Tom Brown's school days and all the rest of it. Well, here it is. McDonald's. Since 1993, McDonald's, a company, has offered teachers in all schools resource packs, which could take the place of a loose of expensive textbooks. History, one pack recommends, should be taught by getting children to, and I quote, explore the changes in the use of the McDonald's site. That's a good history lesson, isn't it? Music teachers were advised to encourage pupils to make up words for Old MacDonald had a store to the tune of Old MacDonald had a farm. And the English pack included such literary tasks as identifying the words Chicken McNuggets. So here in this worship of commodities, taking over the education as well, as the arts, as they're so loftily called, the story is even worse. For instance, in a recent hoo-ha about in London about the National Opera, or the Royal Opera House, here's what's happened. What they think is they need businessmen to run art. After all, the men who understand commodities like high priests must understand everything. They must understand about education. They certainly must understand about art. So it says here in the Observer, and it's quoting Gerald Kaufman, a well-known socialist. He said, last month he forced the resignation of the entire board of the Royal Opera House, and he quotes him, we'd prefer to see the house run by a Philistine with the requisite financial acumen than by the succession of opera and ballet lovers who have brought this great and valuable institution to its knees. In other words, you don't have businessmen deciding what ballet or opera you see, rather than people who are actually interested or trained in the subject. It's even worse when we come to Hollywood. Hooray for Hollywood indeed. That nowadays, one of the major reasons for producing a drama on film is what's the spin-off in it. You know, what commodities can you sell associated with it? And one of the big ones, the big monster movies that's going to be inflicted on us this summer, is Godzilla. Now this thing, foolish thing produced by Sony, costs $120 million to produce. But $60 million are going to be spent in marketing it. And it says here, moreover, Godzilla was released to such a monstrous flood of tie-ins. Cameras from Kodak, tortillas from Taco Bell, watches by Swatch, and beer by Kern. That Robert Levin, Sony's market manager, remarked, we aren't launching a movie, we're launching a franchise. And of course, that is, I mean, if Shakespeare was alive today, I mean, he would never be able to produce Hamlet unless he was sponsored by the Bear Bodkin Knife Company or something like that. In actual fact, he would probably be writing jingles for sanitary towels. He'd be thinking up things like Join the Pepsi Generation or Things Go Better with Coke. Although I must say I always found things went better with rum and coke. But in the Socialist Standard, there's a review of a book called The Doctrines of DNA by R.C. Lewontin. And this is a guy who's one of the leading world geneticists. Oh, I can't say that word, I'm going to try it again. Geneticists. Not bad, comrade.
Yeah.
And this is what he says about science in a commodity-producing society. Science uses commodities and is part of the process of commodity production. Science uses money. People earn their living by science, and as a consequence, the dominant... Right. And further on the question of what scientists do or not, is disinterested men in white coats and that. They live in the real world. This is what he says about molecular biologists. No prominent molecular biologist of my acquaintance is without a financial stake in the biotechnology business. In other words, what's dictating what areas science will even examine is what is profitable. What commodities shall we produce? In fact, they're even copyrighting human genes now, so other people can't use it. But the worst of the lot, in my view, is this wonderful one about Pepsi Cola. It says here that Pepsi plan to trademark the particular shade of blue that coats its products around the globe. And when one of their spokesmen, a guy called Keith Hughes, was asked about it, about copyrighting a particular shade of blue. Now, copyright means somebody can't use it unless you grant them the copyright. It says, we're reviewing the possibilities. We've got some exciting plans, but I really couldn't address that question at this point. I think we already do own that colour of blue. They own it. That seems mad. But in 1995, the United States Supreme Court ruled that a colour can be registered as a trademark, provided there's evidence that shows that the colour has become associated with a particular product. So a modern day Vincent van Gogh painting one of those gorgeous blues, thing would have to say, oh wait a minute, that'd cost too much. I'll change that to ultramarine. I can't afford the copyright on that one. And of course, perhaps the worst thing about how demeaning to human beings this commodity producing society is, in this worship of articles that human beings produce, is this particular one. I said I wouldn't quote again, it's my last quote, comrade, and it is from the Communist Manifesto. I said it was the last Karl Marx quote. Friedrich Engels wrote this bit. The bourgeoisie has stripped of its halo every occupation hitherto honoured and looked up to with reverent awe. It's converted the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the man of science into its paid wage labourers. And has it not just done that? For instance, Mr. Gorbachev, who used to be the leader of the old USSR, and who, I think this is the Guardian or the Observer, it's one of the so-called quality papers, it says this: 10 years ago, Gorbachev was a name with which to move mountains. When he spoke to the UN offering unprecedented troop cuts in Eastern Europe, this newspaper's Washington correspondent said that one could almost feel the earth shifting inside the building. This was a great man. Well, such is the worship and the fetishism of commodities. His next job is with Pizza Hut. Mr. Gorbachev has got a TV advert, by the way. I don't mean he's serving there. He's got a TV advert, and it says, Mr. Gorbachev will be paid more than £100,000 for the adverts. More than Pizza Hut paid to Pamela Anderson. So that's all right. Oh, well, wonder who was a tit there. Right. Now, the important thing from a socialist viewpoint, no matter how much I've skipped through this, and I'll certainly deal with those scholars amongst you who think I've been too flippant here, but sometimes a little humour is permitted, if not overdone. And this is to the last part, very briefly. Of course, inside a socialist society, what we'll have is a production of use values. There will be no commodity production. There will be no need for markets, and there will be no need for all the corruption and all the worship of articles that are produced by capitalism. Education won't be to sell Big Macs. It'll be to make our children aware of the world they live in and to foster the spirit of inquiry and wonder. And science will be free from markets, be free from producing more awful and more awful weapons or chemicals. What we'll have instead is science free to examine all the problems that human beings find in this world. And sport, of course, will return to what it was originally, a communal, enjoyable exercise. Drama and art will be free to construct drama and art that would reflect the real world and the aims and the aspirations and the failures and successes of human beings and the need for human contact. And of course, perhaps the most important thing about it all, as Marx could have put it, is we will stop worshipping a fetish. We will see articles as merely human-produced articles, not something that must be possessed to order to make us real human beings. In that society called socialism, we'll look at the world not on our knees worshipping fetishes, but clear-eyed and clear-headed.